This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, over at Drudge, DrudgeReport.com, it looks like most people thought in the debate last night that Barack Obama won the debate. It's interesting, in the immediate post-debate discussions, what I was hearing was that it seemed that Barack Obama lost the debate or got beat up pretty badly. The overall analysis seems to, at a certain point, seems to, I suppose, be, you know, where you're looking from. But the big losers, I think that there's a relatively broad consensus that the big loser in the debate was ABC, ABC News, Charlie Gibson. And by the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Charlie Gibson, the multimillionaire media celebrity, very concerned about his capital gains tax. And George Stephanopoulos, who used to work for Bill Clinton, in fact, was with him on the cover of Time magazine some years ago, at the end of the debate, the last break, being booed and heckled by the audience.
We'll take one more commercial break. We'll come back. Say goodnight, stay with us. The crowd's turning on me. The crowd is turning on me. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Yeah, isn't that humorous? Well, apparently the crowd didn't think it was all that humorous, and the crowd was turning on them. Now, looking overall at what was said last night, I think that there were a couple of very interesting points. There were some very good points made. There were some strange points made. In the opening remarks, I thought Hillary Clinton did a marvelous job. Barack Obama's opening remarks I thought were good, but they weren't, frankly, as inspiring as many of his speeches that I've seen. You know, when he was here in Portland, I mean, it was just, whoa. But Hillary Clinton, part of her opening remarks where she talked about policy, and this is really her strongest area.
We demonstrate that promise of America is alive and well, but it is at risk. There is a lot of concern across Pennsylvania and America. People do feel as though their government is not solving problems, that it is not standing up for them, that we've got to do more to actually provide the good jobs that will support families, deal once and for all with health care for every American, make our education system the true passport to opportunity, restore our standing in the world. I am running for president because I know we can meet the challenges of today, that we can continue to fulfill that promise that was offered to successive generations of Americans starting here so long ago.
And she pointed out that she and Barack Obama would not have been included in that and in the opening of this country and pointed it out well. So, you know, I thought that was one of the high points of the debate and at least hers. And then, you know, I heard something that I thought was very, very strange, very unusual or odd or something, because my understanding of Hillary Clinton's "I was under sniper fire in Bosnia" remark was that basically she had misremembered or she had flubbed what she said, not that she had lied, not that she made up something and was using it intentionally, that she was saying something that she knew to be incorrect, which is, you know, called a lie. And I was perfectly willing to assume, in fact, you know, Dick Cheney making a joke about it at the correspondents' dinner, I believe this is the clip.
You and the press need to go easy on Senator Clinton on the whole business about running and ducking from gunfire in Bosnia. She made an honest mistake. She confused the Bosnia trip with the time I took her hunting.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I think that the consensus had been, and certainly my belief was, that she actually had made an honest mistake. It is possible to conflate memories. In fact, it happens far more frequently than most people realize. And, you know, mix things up in your brain. Ronald Reagan was the master of it. I mean, you know, he thought he fought in World War II when he didn't. He started a movie about it. He told heads of government about it. But last night, she basically said that she said something that she knew was incorrect, which I thought, wow, she's admitting to having lied.
I may be a lot of things, but I'm not dumb. And I wrote about going to Bosnia in my book in 2004. I laid it all out there. And you're right. On a couple of occasions in the last weeks, I just said some things that weren't in keeping with what I knew to be the case and what...
And, you know, well, here, let me just finish the clip here, in fact.
Case and what I had written about in my book, and, you know, I'm embarrassed by it. I have apologized for it. I've said it was a mistake. It is, I hope, something that you can look over.
Yeah, and at that point, you know, Barack Obama did not come back to that, and the moderators did not come back to that over and over and over again and pile on her, or even, you know, mention her remarks from the 90s that are now being widely reported across the Internet about, you know, when the issue of what about middle-class white people came up. You know, the so-called Reagan Democrats, she is purported to have said in by several people who are in the meeting, well, screw them, you know. It's not, you know, a big deal was not made of that. The thing that struck me the most about the debate last night, and I would be very interested to hear your thoughts on this as well, at 866-303-2270, the thing that struck me the most was that while Charlie Gibson and George Stephanopoulos, particularly in the first hour, but even with the issues later on, kept focusing on the small issues, kept going after the so-called political issues, the gotcha stuff, that and Hillary Clinton did to some significant extent and participated in this, that Barack Obama kept stepping back from those things and saying, you know, wait a minute, there are larger issues here. And even one of his implicit criticisms of Hillary Clinton, where he talked about her baking cookies remark back in the 90s, and, you know, how she was criticized by Republicans for involving herself in health care, and she said, what, am I supposed to stay in the kitchen and bake cookies? And they called her an elitist. And he pointed that out, and then he said that, he, in his opinion, she learned the wrong lesson from that experience.
Senator Clinton's right. She has gone through this. I recall when back in 1992, when she made a statement about how, what do you expect, should I be at home baking cookies? And people attacked her for being elitist and this and that. And I remember watching that on TV and saying, well, that's not who she is. That's not what she believes. That's not what she meant. And I'm sure that that's how she felt as well. But the problem is that that's the kind of politics that we've been accustomed to, and I think Senator Clinton learned the wrong lesson from it, because she's adopting the same tactics.
Yeah, and I suspect that there's a large number of people who feel this, who would agree with that statement. The pastor stuff kept coming up, and they kept piling on, and Barack Obama responding to that. I mean, there was so many times that they were basically coming after him on these things. And here's, let me find the clip here. Here's a response.
There are 8,000 members of Senator Obama's church, and we have heard the inflammatory remarks of Reverend Wright, but so too have we heard testament to many great things that he did. Do you honestly believe that 8,000 people should have gotten up and walked out of that church?
I was asked a personal question, Charlie, and I gave a personal answer. Obviously, one's choice of church and pastor is rooted in what one believes is what you're seeking in church and what kind of fellowship you find in church.
Well, let me just respond to two things.
Yeah, and again, as with the baking cookies remark, Barack Obama said, you know, but that's not really the issue, and did not choose to go, you know, after the minutia, as Hillary Clinton just did. And then he continues.
Absolutely, many of these remarks were objectionable. I've already said that I didn't hear them because I wasn't in church that day. I didn't learn about those statements until much later. But
you did rescind the invitation to him.
But that was on.
So now he's debating. He's debating the moderator.
That was on something entirely different. That was on a different statement. And I think that what Senator Clinton referred to was extremely offensive to me and a lot of people.
Senator, do you think Reverend Wright loves America as much as you?
And they came back to it again.
You do. And number two, if you get the nomination, what will you do when those sermons are played on television again and again and again?
You know, George, look, if it's not this, then it would be something else. I promise you.
See, that's the point. And if not this, it's going to be something else. And here he takes it to the larger picture. We've got to get above this gotcha politics thing.
Senator Clinton got the nomination. There will be a whole bunch of video clips about other things.
You've disowned him?
So, and on it goes. So, anyhow, 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. We've got a little more audio here I'll share with you, and we'll take your calls on last night's debate here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Stick around.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So are the American people smarter than that? Are we actually going to have... Actually, John McCain has called for a campaign with a high level of discourse, said that he would not tolerate swift voting of his opponent, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. I'm assuming that he will be good to that word. And last night, you know, Barack Obama made this comment.
This kind of game in which anybody who I know, regardless of how flimsy the relationship is, it's somehow... somehow their ideas could be attributed to me. I think the American people are smarter than that. They're not going to suggest somehow that that is reflective of my views, because it obviously isn't.
So, and then Hillary Clinton responded, apparently saying, yeah, good idea, but the American people aren't really smarter than that.
Well, I think that is a fair general statement. But I also believe that Senator Obama served on a board with Mr. Ayers for a period of time, the Woods Foundation, which was a paid directorship position. And if I'm not mistaken, that relationship with Mr. Ayers on this board continued after 9/11 and after his reported comments, which were deeply hurtful to people in New York.
That would be Ayers' comments. And, you know, Barack Obama could have, if he wanted to get in the mud, he could have come back and said, well, what about your years on the board of Walmart, for example, something. But he didn't go there. And I thought that was a good and noble thing, frankly, I just have to say. Matt in Beaverton, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, you know, I think that our country, I mean, we all agree that it's in a lot of trouble, and we're watching these debates to find out who's going to be the best person to get us out of this trouble. And I feel like, you know, George Stephanopoulos and
Charlie Gibson.
Excuse me. Right. You know, they're just asking gossip questions. Is that what they think America really wants to hear?
I think they do. Yeah, I really do. And this, you know, keep in mind, ABC, NBC, CBS, they have, by and large, since the mid 90s, certainly after the end of the Fairness Doctrine in 78, you know, or 87 rather, Reagan, and
right.
The Telecommunications Act in 96, they combined their news divisions with their entertainment divisions. They're now using their news divisions as profit centers. They're shutting down their news gathering operations. They no longer do investigative journalism. The phrase tabloid questions has been used over and over and over again. And I would say, yeah, they get it that they're in the business of selling salacious stuff. They're in the business of selling gossip. They're in the business of getting eyeballs for viewers, you know, and if it's Britney Spears or if it's missing white girls in Aruba or whatever it is, they're going to go for it. And this is that, frankly, the questions that were thrown out, at least particularly in the first half of the debate last night, fell squarely into that category, in my opinion. Matt in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Matt.
Hey, welcome to South Florida. It's nice to have you on the radio during the daytime.
Thank you, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
In fact, you're more fun than the last guy. You know, a lot of people seem to forget that when the Clintons were in the White House, we all kind of shook our heads and said, what kind of sleazy thing are they going to come up with next? And it seems to be translating to their campaign. And frankly, it's the same old people, same old ideas. and the same results. And I have to say,
Matt, you know, do you realize that you're doing the same thing that I was just saying that Hillary, or not so much Hillary, although she, I think she participated in it, but in particular Stephanopoulos and Gibson were doing last night, which is reducing the debate to the level of personal attack. I mean, I remember
Absolutely.
The Clinton administration, and I had a lot of problems with Bill Clinton's policies. I didn't, you know, I can't think of a time, though, when I thought that he was or Hillary were being sleazy. I mean, that was a Republican attack.
Well, you know, I'm more of a libertarian than a Democrat, but I just switched from the Republican because, I mean, seeing George Bush, forget it. But the point is that, you know, the Clintons have slipped to a very low level in their campaign attacks against Obama. And quite frankly, when I watch Obama and listen to what he has to say, he seems to be above the fray. And the bottom line is, if this is the way he's going to conduct himself as president of the United States, we're going to end up with somebody who's elegant and has some class and may lift us back where we ought to be.
Yeah, Matt, I absolutely agree with that sentiment. And I, you know, and people say, oh, he's elitist. So is John Kennedy. And in his unflappability, in Barack Obama's unflappability, I see John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Alex in Los Angeles. Hey, Alex, we've got just a minute here before the break.
Just real quick, at the beginning, it seemed as though people were claiming that everybody was being too hard on Hillary, and I don't really recall that, so I could be wrong. But last night, the debate didn't start until well over an hour into it, and that question that Stephanopoulos asked about does Reverend Wright love this country was ludicrous. It was ridiculous. It had no place there. And quite honestly, when Oberman brought up the fact that Hannity had asked him to ask another question, it just seemed as though Stephanopoulos, I don't know, it felt as though all of a sudden they were on the Republican payroll or the Clinton payroll last night.
Or they were trying to prove that they were not, you know, friendly, you know, suck up, you know, whatever media. You know, I'm not sure what the equation was, but Alex, what they're when they sat down in their strategy sessions and they planned out the questions, and make no mistake, this was very, very carefully thought through and planned out. What kind of image they were trying to establish, or you know, what their goal was, I honestly don't know. But I think it came off rather poorly. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I'm that good feeling. I'm that voice. Yeah, you know who I am. Listen, oh. It's your choice. Yeah, you know who I, you know who I am.
34 minutes past the hour. Dan McGuire sent me our crazy alert for the day. Barack Obama, he says, he's such an elitist. Did you know that he comes from a very rich family? In fact, his father back in Kenya was a goat herder. That means he owned an entire herd of goats. How many Kenyans own even one goat? Not too many. A snob? You have no idea. When Barack Obama Sr. came home with an extravagant portion of bushmeat, they'd sit around the palatial hut and serve up dinner and turn up their noses if the mustard was anything other than Grey Poupon. And Obama's mother? What a snooty broad. She devoted her life to helping poor people in impoverished third world countries. Nothing more elitist than caring about people in poor countries. Trying to redistribute money from the rich to the poor. Real Americans try to teach those folks the value of hard work by paying them 5 cents a day to work in sweatshops making $85 sneakers. John McCain's family didn't have any goats either. He was not an elitist. His father was a four-star admiral in the Navy. That may sound elitist, but you have no idea how badly the four-star admirals were treated by the five-star admirals. Goats were completely out of the question for the McCain family. Did you know they won't even allow you to keep goats on an aircraft carrier? And he didn't come from a wealthy family, and nor did he acquire his wealth from dubious activities like writing best-selling books like that elitist Obama. No, McCain's wealth came honorably. He divorced his broke first wife and married an heiress who funded his political career. Americans respect that kind of entrepreneurial pluck. Pluck, with a P. 36 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tom in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, but I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I have a question for you. I was wondering how Senator Clinton managed to get through the entire debate last night without having to discuss anything with regards to the Columbia Free Trade Agreement, Mark Penn, and the former president's money that was involved with lectures and, I guess, things associated with the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. Could you comment on that, please?
I do not disagree with this sentiment. This is from today's Financial Times. You know, the Financial Times, the world's financial newspaper. It's the elites talking to the elites. It's out of the UK. They don't have a dog in this race. And the headline says, Clinton finds an ally in McCain. And here's the first sentence. This is the first sentence, the first paragraph. The 2008 presidential race has boiled down to a fight of two against one. John McCain and Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama. Mrs. Clinton and Mr. McCain are using virtually identical criticisms against Mr. Obama and largely avoiding targeting each other. Many Democrats believe Mrs. Clinton has overstepped the line. And then they quote Gary Hart and Tad Devine, who is John Kerry's senior advisor, who has not taken a position in this. Both saying, well, Tad Devine, he says, 1 + 1 = 0 if your ally is a Republican. Mrs. Clinton may have damaged herself among Democrats more than she is damaging Mr. Obama. And this is what I've been saying. I think that she is doing harm to herself more than she is doing harm to him by these kind of things. In fact, the Financial Times, there are signs that Mrs. Clinton's tactics may also be causing self-inflicted damage. Aides to Mr. McCain admit that they would prefer Mrs. Clinton as an opponent in general election. Last week, they go on to point out, she likened herself to Rocky, but unlike Stallone's movie character, many Democrats believe Mrs. Clinton is fighting dirty. That's the Financial Times. And I think that Charlie Gibson and George Stephanopoulos last night, whether they were trying to prove that they're not, in bed with the Democrats or whether, I don't know. I don't even want to guess their motivations. I just thought it was tragic. Kenny, in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, Tom. That was the worst debate I have ever seen last night. And we seemed like Hillary was running that John McCain running mate. And it seemed like ABC was running the RNC for opposition research against Barack. Questions like, pledge you're not going to raise taxes. That's a Republican tactic. I mean, yeah. Half these questions that they gave in the first part was all type of Republican setup questions that, I mean, the military question, well, if the generals say this, are you going to absolutely go against the generals? I mean, what kind of questions are these?
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. They were using Republican frames to try to basically corner the Democratic candidates. And you could argue, and in fact, I think it's true, that it's probably a good thing that this happened last night and that it's happening now rather than in October or November, because it is strengthening the Democratic candidates. It's giving them an opportunity to rebut these things and respond to them. But there was some stuff that was just plain old, you know, not just Republican talking points, but Republican. I mean, I got the RNC notes this morning on Barack Obama, and, you know, I'll share those with you a little later in the program, but boy, oh boy, it's all about taxes. And this is Charlie Gibson last night.
Again. You would favor an increase in the capital gains tax.
Now, the capital gains tax, the capital gain is if you hold a stock or say you build a business and you sell that business or a stock, if you hold it for a short term for less than a year, actually it's varied over the years, how long is a short term gain and how long is a long term gain, you pay a tax on the gain. So, in other words, if you make your living buying and selling stocks, as opposed to buying and selling shoes, then you pay a different tax rate. You know, the guy who makes his living buying and selling stocks pays a different tax rate than the guy who makes his living buying and selling shoes. You buy and sell shoes, you pay income tax. You buy and sell stocks, you pay capital gains tax. And so Charlie Gibson says, you know, hey, wait a minute, you want to raise the capital gains tax? Because George Bush has it set right now where the maximum capital gains tax is 15%.
As a matter of fact, he said on CNBC, and I quote, I certainly would not go above what existed under Bill Clinton, which was 28%. It's now 15%. That's almost a doubling if you went to 28%. But actually, Bill Clinton in 1997 signed legislation that dropped the capital gains tax to 20%.
Right.
And George Bush has taken it down to 15%. Right. And in each instance, When the rate dropped, revenues from the tax increased.
Now, let me, and when the rate goes up, revenues go down. That is true within a one-year window. Let me give you an example. In 1993, Louise and I started a business in 1983, excuse me, started a business in Atlanta called International Wholesale Travel with a retail business, Sprayberry Travel, both a wholesale and retail travel business. Within 3 years, we had it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It was doing $6 million a year in sales. It did $24 million in sales last year. It's generated over $250 million in the years since we started that company. And in 86, we had a good, solid, strong, thriving business with 20 employees that was doing well, and we thought, okay, we'll cash out on this thing. And the tax law was changed in November of 86. In October, November of 86 was the tax, whatever it was called, Tax Reform Act of 1986, and the capital gains tax was going to increase. And so we got it. If we held on to that company for one more year, we'd pay more taxes on selling the company than we would if we sold it that year. So we sold it in June of 86. And we moved to Europe and spent a year living in Germany, you know, put our kids in the public schools and basically retired for a while before we came back to the United States and started another business. And lived off the money that we got from selling that company. And we got more money because the capital gains tax was lower at that point, and then it got raised in 86. So, yeah, when, you know, people make decisions to buy or sell based on tax policy, but those are relatively instantaneous. If, you know, over the course of the, if you average those things over a 5 or 10 year period, it makes no difference. It makes it, because people are eventually going to sell the things that they own that have value, or they're eventually going to buy things that will consequently have value. But Charlie Gibson kept pushing this meme as if there was some truth to it.
The government took in more money, and in the 1980s, when the tax was increased to 28%, the revenues went down.
Now, that was in the following year, because in the year of 86, when I sold my business, the revenues actually went up, because everybody knew that in 87 the tax increase was coming, so the revenues went down. If you average them, it was irrelevant.
So why raise it at all, especially given the fact that 100 million people in this country own stock and would be affected?
No, they wouldn't be affected. Most people who own stock in this country own stock in 401ks, which are protected from taxes until they retire. And when they retire, they're in such a low tax bracket that they would pay no capital gains tax. Because right now, if you pay less, if you're in the 25% or lower, 24% or lower income tax bracket, you have no capital gains tax. It's indexed just like income taxes are. So, you know, Charlie Gibson, the whole premise was wrong.
Well, Charlie, what I've said is that I would look at raising the capital gains tax for purposes of fairness. And part of what has happened is that those who are able to work the stock market and amass huge fortunes on capital gains are paying a lower tax rate than their secretaries.
Which is what Warren Buffett pointed out. He pays less taxes as a percentage of his income than his secretary does, and that's wrong.
That's not fair.
But history shows that when you drop the capital gains tax, the revenues go up.
Right. See, and here you have the commentator, the moderator, debating the candidate. Wait a minute, I thought that the candidates were supposed to be debating each other. But Charlie keeps putting out these Republican talking points that just plain old flat out aren't even true. That's the stuff that really made me crazy last night. Jason in Detroit, listening on WDTW. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Just great.
Hey, I think we're letting a big segment of the population off the hook here, because I think the crux of the problem is the standards that the American public demand, not only are their politicians, but are their media. And one thing that really upsets me, and I've noticed this, Hillary Clinton and McCain, they've kind of been tacting towards this group of Democrats, these Reagan Democrats, who I believe, one, are not going to vote for a black man and are not going to vote for a woman. So why are we letting them dictate our debate on the Democratic side of the table?
Well, it may or may not be, Jason. I don't know, but I agree with you that we need to raise the level of discussion in this country. And I think, frankly, Americans are growing up enough for that.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
The high road would be a fine thing. Joe in Los Angeles. Hey, Joe, welcome to the show. What's up?
Hi, I'm on the air right now?
You certainly are.
Great. Hey, listen, I'm a Hillary supporter, although by demographics I should be a Barack. I'm educated, upper middle class. I'm a snob. But what I'm amazed by is, I don't mean this in a bad way, but the whining and complaining that the Barack supporters are expressing. If Barack wins, he's going to owe a big debt to Hillary Clinton because she is challenging him, number one. And if he loses, she's going to get blamed. Like a stereotypical woman, she's going to get too much blame.
Joe, I think you're absolutely right on both points. And frankly, there's truth to both points as well. But I'm curious. You say, you know, the Barack supporters are whining. What are they whining about?
They're whining that he finally got. He's been a front runner for over 2 months, and they finally dished just a little bit of what this lady has been dealing with for months and months, for a year.
For years.
She has been taking it, and she has to be so careful how she says things and reacts and stuff, because the sexism and misogyny in this culture is far more prevalent and far more deeply rooted than racism, and they're both horrible problems. Yeah. But the misogyny and sexism is not really being dealt with.
I agree with you, and I've made that point a number of times on the program. Nonetheless, I just have to say I think that the debate last night, if the moderators were going to go after the candidates, they should have gone after both of the candidates. And
but the point is, the point I'm making,
I don't think either one of them was well served by that.
I don't know. We're not going to be well served if we don't see Barack under pressure. And it's about us, the voters. It's not about either of these candidates. And Barack really needs to take a few more shots.
Well, that was my point where I said, if he hadn't answered those questions last night, he would be having to answer them in October and November because those are Republican questions. And so in that context, and in that point, and Joe, I agree with you, and thanks for the call. In that context, it's a great thing that those questions came out and he had an opportunity to answer them. And maybe even put some of this stuff behind him. You know, we'll see. We'll see. Lakshmi in Oakland, California, listening on K-Green.
Hi, Tom. This is Lakshmi.
Or Green 960. Yeah, hi, Lakshmi.
Hi. Thank you so much for all you do. You are so brilliant. I feel like I'm going to college every day when I listen to you.
Well, thank you.
You know, I thought last night was sad. It was the worst debate I've ever seen, the worst of this political campaign. And I feel like Hillary and those moderators did a virtual lynch mob against Barack, and it's not right. It's not right, Tom.
It's what happens when you're the front runner. I think that one of the things that last night's debate ratified is that Barack Obama is the front runner because everybody was going after him, and that's what happens when you're the front runner. And if you can't push back against that when you're the front runner, then you're no longer the front runner.
Well, and bless his heart, you know, he has such integrity. There's so many times he could take her on about stuff, but he stays on that high road. And I'm for Barack Obama till the day I die. That's how much I love him. And I just feel like last night was just like, it was horrible.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you, Lakshmi, for sharing your perspective with us. Laverne in Iowa. Hey, Laverne.
Couple of quick points. One is I'm tired of hearing about white guilt as the motive for people voting for Obama. I'm in Iowa, and we're 96% white. Two,
Hang on just a second. I have never heard that put forward.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, I've heard it a lot.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. You live in Iowa. Okay.
No, I hear it on national news and on talk radio.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Two, McCain last summer, before his campaign kind of caved in, he had hired the Swift Boat people and the same folks that attacked him about his adopted child.
Right. He hired one of them, and he hired the PR company that was associated with
it. For the other one.
Yeah.
Three, I think Hillary had an opportunity last night to step back from the trash talk, and it would have given her, I think, great gravitas. But instead, she got down in the mud, and I'm wondering how can somebody who fights so dirty govern clean?
Well, it's, you know, on the other hand, how can somebody who refuses to fight dirty take on a Republican? And that's, see, that's the big debate that's happening inside the Democratic Party, is it actually possible in the United States to have the kind of debate that Richard Nixon and John Kennedy had in the 1960s, which was entirely about issues, you know, genuinely and entirely about issues? I encourage you to, you can hear the old 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debates
I'm
web.
I'm 69 and a half. I watched them and I voted for Kennedy.
Yeah. And you know, is the American public as grown up as they were in 1960? And can we have that kind of debate? And frankly, what I'm hearing from both Obama and McCain is that they both actually want to have that kind of debate. Now, whether their campaigns are going to have those kind of debates, I don't know. But I get your point that Hillary Clinton has not been conducting that kind of debate. She's been doing kind of more of the politics as normal for the past decade or so. And Laverne, thank you for the call. On the assumption that's what wins elections, that's what won George Bush, you know, a couple of terms, that's what won for Reagan, that maybe, arguably even that's what won for Bill Clinton, and therefore it has to continue. I don't know. We'll see. Time will tell on this. Jeff in North Carolina. Hey, Jeff, just a half a minute before we got to wrap up this hour.
Well, good afternoon. First of all, the previous caller from Iowa, I have heard the white guilt thing as well.
It must be all over right-wing talk radio or something, because I've heard it, but it, you know, so rarely.
Actually, I hear it from Republicans face to face. You know, you're voting for Barack because you're guilty. You feel guilty because you're a white man. The point I was mainly wanting to bring up was I travel all over North Carolina in my profession, and I do have an Obama bumper sticker on my car. Mm-hmm. And so many people give me their reasons for not supporting him and not voting for him, and it just amazes me. It's things like, I'm afraid of his name.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that he's,
yeah.
You know, it's
the guy, you know, he was a Muslim. No, he wasn't. You know, his middle name is Hussein. Yes, it is. But what does that have to do with anything? Yeah, he didn't put his hand over his heart when he sang the national anthem. What? 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, let's step back and go
now behind enemy lines.
Yeah, let's find out what the RNC has to say here. I have the RNC research briefing, Obama's taxing trick. At last night's debate, Obama said he wouldn't tax the middle class, but his capital gains and payroll tax hikes would hit middle-income earners. Terry Jeffries is with us. He is the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. CNS News, well, that's the website, CNSNews.com as well. Terry, welcome.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you back with us. As a conservative, as a Republican, what was your take on last night's debate?
Well, I thought there's a lot of interesting things that were said in last night's debate, but if you want to focus on the economic aspect of it, I did find it interesting that both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama wanted to present themselves as tax cutters and not tax raisers. I thought that was sort of an interesting thing.
Well, Obama said that he would raise the cap on Social Security for people who make more than $250,000 a year, so that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are paying the same tax rate that, you know, that their secretaries are for Social Security, and solve the Social Security problem that way. And he said that he would raise capital gains taxes so that people who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive in the mail are paying the same income tax rate that you and I are. Presumably you're drawing a paycheck.
Well, I don't think he promised that he wasn't going to raise the income cap on the payroll tax for people making over $97,000 a year.
No, he said he was going to do a donut hole thing.
He said he would consider that, if I understood him correctly. So he'll do that, maybe he won't. And I suppose it depends on how much money they tell him they can get from either alternative tax, but I didn't hear him say he was pledging not to raise taxes on those people. Whereas Senator Clinton was saying she wouldn't do it, which actually was a pretty positive development for her, I thought, because I think that is a regressive tax.
So you think it's a positive development for a Democrat to talk like a Republican?
I think it is a good thing when Democrats recognize that middle class people in this country are overtaxed. As Hillary Clinton pointed out, there are a lot of middle class people who are whose family income is over $97,000 a year, and there are a lot of communities in this country where it takes that kind of money to even live the semblance of a middle class life.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but what we have right now, if you looked at 1952, for example, and this is I'm taking this from the Berkshire Hathaway annual report. In 1952, the total of federal tax receipts, 32% of all federal tax receipts, were corporate taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, it was 7.4%.
Yeah.
The middle class is being taxed to death because fat cats and big corporations are not paying their fair share of the cost of the commons. And you know, I mean, that's just a simple reality. So when you say, yeah, the middle class is being taxed to death, you know, hallelujah, I'm right there with you. And what I was hearing them both say is, yes, the middle class is being taxed to death. In fact, Barack Obama came out and he said, I'm saying let's cut their taxes.
Well, you hear, I mean, well, the step one step further back from it, I'm in favor of any kind of tax cut anywhere. And I'm also in favor of cutting overall federal spending. I think part of the problem the Democrats have, both of these candidates have, is they want to increase federal government spending, and they also say they want to cut taxes for one group of people.
But people want that. People want to have a national health care system in the United States, and that's going to increase federal spending. It's also going to increase taxes.
Well, I can tell you
why not have some of that increase fall on corporations who are disproportionately using our commons. They're certainly using more than 7% of our court system, our financial systems, our you know, public education, our roads, our air infrastructure, everything else. Certainly more than 7%. Why are they only paying 7% of the share of it?
Well, as a matter of self-interest, if you could tax everybody else and not tax me, I'd be in favor. I'm for the Terry Jeffrey tax abolition.
No, come on, Terry. I know that you're not that glib.
But here's the answer to your question. The truth is, when you tax corporations, you're actually taxing people in a whole number of ways. First of all, people own stock in corporations, including a lot of your listeners who have money in mutual funds and in 401ks and things like that. Secondly, corporations are just going to pass through the cost to you in the form of increased prices when you go to buy their product.
No, it's not.
Where does the corporation get the money to pay the tax? They get the money to pay the tax by selling a product to you.
No, they get the money to pay the tax by decreasing the dividend that they pay to the people who earn their living sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. It's the stockholders that they'll take it out.
See, the stockholders are regular middle-class Americans who hold stock in these companies in their retirement plans and in other ways. So one way or another, you...
And that's it's a relatively small percentage of Americans who own enough stock to be of any consequence, number one. And number two, that doesn't mean that corporations are going to become unprofitable. In 1952, corporations were doing very well, thank you very much. And they were paying a third of the cost to the commons.
But there's another way that it has an impact on regular Americans. You tax the corporation, you take away money that could be used for investment, that could create the next job. And also, when you tax the corporation as well as the individual on the margin, and a lot of the businesses that are creating jobs are actually just individuals who are in business, you take away the incentive to create the new jobs, to grow the business, and to grow the economy.
Terry, if you really believe that, I'm astounded.
I do really believe
Then you've never started a business. I started because I saw a market opportunity. I said, hey, there are people who want this product. There are people who want what I can produce. There's nobody else doing it, or I can do it better than the other guy, and did so and made money doing
right,
it, regardless of the tax rates. I've done it when tax rates were high, when they were low.
And if the question, well, actually, it's demonstrably true. I mean, the data does demonstrate that if you increase the marginal take of the government from the increased investment, the profit someone makes from an increased investment, they're less likely to invest. And it only makes sense when you...
They may be less likely to invest in a factory in China.
Well, that is another consequence of raising taxes. If you raise the cost of business in the United States, these businesses, to the degree that they can, will move overseas where the cost is not as high. That is not a good thing.
It's not a good thing. So let's do away with the insane trade policies that your party has brought up.
Well, let's within reason.
And a few Democrats as well.
Well, within reason, let's make the United States of America an attractive place for people to establish businesses and grow their businesses.
As a percentage of GDP, we have the fourth lowest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world.
Well, which is a good
thing. What more do you need to do?
Which is a good thing. But you and I, Tom, probably fundamentally disagree on whether we need all this government. I think there's a lot of things.
All this government?
Yeah, I think the government is doing a great many things it ought not to be doing. It's squandering money.
For example?
I'd get rid of the Federal Department of Education. It does absolutely no good. There's no evidence that any in Bush's massively increased federal education spending while test scores have stagnated. There's no evidence.
What percentage of the federal budget are we talking about here, Terry?
I think we're talking about almost $70 billion this year. That's a good chunk of change.
Right. So that's 0.7% of a $1 trillion budget.
I think the taxpayers would take that $70 billion back.
0.7%?
$70 billion.
Yeah.
Also, I would reform.
And I would suggest to you that, you know, Title I, Title IX, Title IV, there are a number of federal education programs that are vital for schools. There are schools, particularly in small towns and communities across America, that don't have the funds to deal with special needs kids. And without federal funding available for them, they're going to be just screwed. I mean, they're going to be in big trouble.
Why can't the states and counties take care of that?
Because in many cases, you've got states that don't have a lot of cash. You've got right now, we're sliding into another Republican Great Depression. We're looking at as much as a $300 billion cut next year in revenue to the states as a consequence of this recession that we're in. And you know, they're running out of cash. And you've got small communities that can't afford this kind of stuff.
Well, what you're saying is that these states have become dependent on the federal government and federal taxation for programs that they can run if the federal government wasn't taxing money away from the people and taking a cut here in Washington, D.C. for a bunch of bureaucrats who just add another layer to government that we
No, I'm need. Saying that the states are dependent upon revenues that are you know, property taxes by and large and local sales taxes, you know, sales taxes and corporate taxes and personal income taxes in ways that in many cases some state, you know, the bottom line, and you know this, the blue states are paying more into the federal government than they're getting back, and the red states are drawing more out than they're putting in.
Well, you know, that is true.
And so let's just say that the Republican states have to start paying the exact amount in that they're getting out, and the Democratic states start getting back what they're paying in.
Why send it to Washington in the first place? I mean, here's a good example. I think the state of Connecticut actually has the largest deficit with the federal government. They pay the most taxes and get less back. The differential there is the mess. People in Connecticut are paying money that comes down to Washington that the federal government pumps into.
This is because you've got a lot of millionaires and billionaires in Connecticut.
Well, but wait a minute. They're sending money down to Washington, D.C. Part of that is going into the Washington, D.C. public schools, which spend more per pupil than any public schools in the whole country, about $16,000 per pupil. And the test scores are going down in the District of Columbia. So the federal government.
So let's get rid of No Child Left Behind and let's empower teachers to teach.
Well, they were dismal before No Child Left Behind. But what's happening is middle-class people in Connecticut are sending taxes to Congress who are giving it to bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. who can't run schools with $16,000 per student.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting, always an interesting conversation, Terry. I appreciate it. Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief over at CNSNews.com. If you want to get their take on the debate last night, check out CNSNews.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Think of the future.
I have confidence in the American people that when you talk to the American people honestly and directly about what I believe in, what my plans are on health care, on energy, when they see my track record of the work that I've done on behalf of people who really need help, I have absolute confidence that they can rally behind my campaign. And, you know, the notion that somehow that the American people are going to be distracted once again by comments not made by me, but somebody who is associated with me, that I have disowned, I think doesn't give the American people enough credit.
So, are we giving the American people enough credit? Are we smart enough for an actual debate on actual issues, or is it going to be John Kerry windsurfing or Michael Dukakis' helmet in the tank routine? The Republicans have turned this into a fine art, And it seems to me that the Democrats are running around going, oh, my God, here come the Republicans again. We got to get ready. We got to get ready. And we got to be careful that we don't have anybody with a picture in a tank, and we don't have anybody with a picture windsurfing, and we don't have anybody, being too wooden. And what happened to the discussion about the issues? Elizabeth in West Hollywood, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Elizabeth, welcome to the show. What's up?
Hi. Well, I just paid my taxes on Wednesday. I mean, I'm on Tuesday, and I had such a shock. And this is after hearing from a friend that she saw in, of all places, the Parade magazine that comes in the paper. Mine didn't come. That Kellogg Brown and Root paid absolutely zero, and they're in the Cayman Islands as
That's
a corporation.
Right. Once the war started, they reincorporated in the Cayman Islands so that they would be free of federal taxes on all the money that they're making from their operations in Iraq on our behalf.
Yeah, and Halliburton, too. But my question is, well, first of all, I was so...
Halliburton actually has moved to Dubai.
Dubai, right. Here I am, just a poor county employee, ex-retired county employee, we're living on my pension. Well, I did pretty well, actually, because I invested in the 401 plan there. But I'm getting my pension, and I got a one-time payment for sick time, which, by the way, the county cheated me out of because I only got 50% of my sick time.
Oops.
But I saved it up in case there was a...
But your point, Elizabeth.
Well, the point is that why should a foreign company who is making huge profits, both KBR and Halliburton,
why should they pay no federal taxes?
Yeah.
Income taxes.
It's
a very good question. Absolutely. And spot on. And that's my point. I mean, thank you for the call. We've got corporations paying only 7% of the cost of the commons in the United States. Only 7%. And who are the major users of our court system, which is relatively expensive? Corporations. It's not crooks. It's not guys who stick up 7-Eleven. The major users of our court system are corporations to enforce contracts. Who are the major users of our police and fire? Corporations. The major amount of protection that is done, arguably the major amount of protection that is done, is a commercial property. In that category, that's a somewhat disingenuous number because it includes rental property. But nonetheless, there it is. You go right through the comments. I mean, who is making use of our educated workforce that we're paying for with our tax dollars? You know, corporations are profiting from it. Shouldn't they be paying for it in some way? I mean, and our roads. I mean, who's our airways? Not just our airways, like I'm talking to you on right now, but I'm talking about our airplane airways. I mean, our transportation infrastructure. Anyhow, it goes on and on. Pat in Granite Falls, Washington. Hey, Pat.
Oh, good morning, Tom. Now, I'm telling you this. I have to go along with the way people have been talking. I'm 83 years old. I remember Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Our country was in some distress at that time, too. But there was a voice that came across giving us hope and trust. And that is what Barack Obama is doing and asking us to hope and to trust. And we do trust him. And furthermore, he is trusting us to be intelligent Americans, which we are. We're not little bobbleheads saying, oh, my goodness, everything is wrong. We are listening to every word given out, listening.
But we did look at those. We did look at Michael Dukakis in the tank and freak out. And we did, we did look at John Kerry windsurfing and freak out. I mean, are the American people that dumbed down? You think not?
No, because we have little computers up there in our heads. We've taken all that in. It's good. It's really good to remember all of that and know what's coming. I was so incensed last night by Charlie Gibson that he's not going to be on at 5:30 in this house. Absolutely not. Because if you treat somebody unfairly who is trying to tell us the truth and trying to help his country.
That's it for you, Pat. No more ABC and no more Mickey Mouse, eh? Pat, thank you for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're
tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Night after night, I try to make it all fit together. Night after night, I see you as someone I remember. You took me by surprise, opened up my eyes. Now we gotta talk this over. Can it really be so serious to be all broken up and delirious? I guess we've really been...
So sometimes endorsements come from the strangest quarters. Our conservative alert for the day. Hillary's most recent endorsement.
The only one I don't want to win is Obama because I know he's a Marxist in his heart.
Michael Savage.
He's an Afro-Leninist and I know he's dangerous. Hillary, I know what to expect from her, which is 8 horrible years, but I'm not so sure she's still a Leninist. Her husband has made so much money in so many different capitalist ways that I actually think they've matured and become good Americans.
Oh, yes. Endorsements come from the strangest places. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Tom in Long Beach, California. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, you know, though, I was really disappointed in the way that ABC ran this debate last night. I just thought it was despicable. I mean, here you got a president who has talked to, who is authorized torture, who has authorized illegal wiretapping, who's presided over one of the largest economic and housing market collapses in history. And all these guys can talk about is flag pins.
I know. Yeah. This is the point. They're the first half hour. Well, actually, the entire thing. The entire debate was conducted in the context of Republican frames.
Absolutely. They didn't even get into a slightly substantive question. They just kept trying to get these gotcha questions about, you know, the right thing or about the bitter comment or about Hillary's Bosnia nonsense. I mean, it's like they didn't even get into a substantive question for maybe 45 minutes.
Yeah.
That's like half the debate. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. Tom, I think there's a lot of folks who agree with you. Absolutely. Thanks for the call. Mike in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Hey, Mike.
Hey, I got three quick points. Mark Foley, Vitter, Larry Craig, and Scooter Libby all wore lapel pins all the time, so that doesn't show anything.
There you go.
Secondly, if name association has anything to do with people's credibility, then John Wayne Gacy would be an American icon and a hero. Third, Clinton and this elitism with Obama. Her husband, Bill Clinton, is associated with the Trilateral Organization, the Council for Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers. And Hillary Clinton was the first woman to ever speak to the Bilderbergers in the early 1990s. And these, regardless of what you think their agenda is, are all elitist think tanks. So for them to call somebody elitist is a little bit hypocritical.
Yeah. Interesting point, Mike. And by the way, speaking of the flag, I'm looking at the USFlag.org, the flag of the United States, flag etiquette. The flag should not be used as part of a costume or athletic uniform, except that a flag patch may be used on the uniform of military personnel, firemen, policemen, and members of patriotic organizations. That would be, you know, like the disabled American veterans kind of thing. So, you know, they had this woman on and she said, you know, our firemen and our policemen wear flags on their uniforms. Why won't you wear a flag on your suit? Well, because it's not a uniform. A suit is not a uniform. It's not a costume. Oh, my. I mean, you know, the whole thing. Joe in Miami, Florida. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yeah, hi. Glad to take my call. I was pretty disgusted with that assault by ABC on Obama, 55 minutes of that stuff. But there was one thing that I found very, very interesting. When Clinton went on regarding what she would do if somebody attacked a neighbor in the Middle East. He says, oh, we'll come after him with the full force.
Well, hang on. Here's the actual clip, I believe. Here it is.
We will let the Iranians know that, yes, an attack on Israel would trigger massive retaliation, but so would an attack on those countries that are willing to go under the security umbrella and forswear their own nuclear ambitions. And finally...
And then she goes on and talking about we can't have Iran having nuclear power.
Yes, I could see where she's, starting to target Iran.
But I don't think that we have bilateral treaties or multilateral treaties with any of those countries in the region that are mutual defense treaties like we have with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, with the NATO countries, which basically says, you know, an attack on you is an attack on me. It was those kind of treaties, by the way, which we've been very wary of entering into, that caused World War One to go from the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand into World War One. Because, you know, he gets assassinated in Sarajevo, and now, you know, as I recall, and I, you know, the sequence, I've probably got it all jumbled in my brain because it's been 30 years since I learned this stuff, but, you know, wasn't it, the Austro-Hungarian Empire then had to declare war on the Serbs, and then the Serbs were allies with Russia, so Russia had to declare war on the Hungarians and the Austrians, and then the Austrians had a mutual defense treaty with the Germans, so the Germans had to declare war on the Russians, and that, you know, and it just kind of echoed out from there. Everybody had a treaty with somebody else, and boom, instantly you had a world war. Okay. I don't think that we have those kind of treaties. I mean, maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't think that we have those kind of treaties with the countries of the Middle East. I think that she was proposing radical change in our foreign policy.
Yeah, she mentioned Israel as one example. Now, on the treaty thing.
Well, that's always been known. I mean, we have always, there, even without a treaty, we have always explicitly said that Israel is, you know, a democracy in the region that we have a long and strong association with, and if they're attacked, we're going to take it very seriously. And Barack Obama said, you know, he would have an appropriate response. That's been the language that every president has used before now.
Exactly.
But to use this language of overwhelming response, that sounds more like George W. Bush's policies.
Right. And again, Iran being the target. And yes, Hillary did vote for the Kyle Lieberman Amendment, which to me, possibly she's got the same possible agenda as McCain.
Yeah, which identified the Iranian army as a terrorist organization. It's possible, Joe. It's possible. I don't know. We're going to have to see how this plays out. And whether you know, any questions are asked about this. Dwayne, Portland, Maine. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Glad to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
I've been a great fan of yours for a long, long time, and I read your book, We the People, that was illustrated by Neil Cohen.
Yo, thank you. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorites. It's a great,
it's really
history
great
of the United
book.
States. Thank you.
And I think it should be made available in high schools. If that's, I don't know if that'd be possible.
Well, the publisher, you know, there's probably six or seven references in there that could be taken as political, and the rest of it is fairly, you know, broad stroke American history, American politics.
Right.
And the publisher was going to be putting together a special edition that did not have the liberal bias that is in the current issue of We the People, and make it available to schools. And I haven't heard from him in a while on that, so I don't know where it's at. But I agree. I think it should be available to schools.
Really should.
But anyhow, that's not what you called about.
Right. I wanted to talk about the media. I know a lot of people say that they're just lazy. You know, they go to Drudge for talking points. But I really believe that they've got some sort of an agenda that they're pushing. I mean, you could see it with Hillary's language. It's really lifted straight from the neocon agenda in terms of, you know, you were getting to the point about the alliances that caused the problem before World War One, that really led to World War One. I mean, we don't want... I believe that the media does have some sort of an agenda that they're really pushing with this constant drumbeat about Iran. And it seems to me that while we're really trying to get the media to take our point of view and to add substance into the debate and have substantive questions, if we are just calling and petitioning them to add some sort of substantive questions in debates like this, what are the chances of us succeeding?
I think ABC is getting an earful right now. I think they're getting an enormous amount of blowback. It's, you know, people are not at all happy with what happened.
Right.
And hopefully they will take that to heart. But let us not forget that for the major media corporations, war is incredibly profitable, and not just because at least one of them is also a defense contractor and others have interlocking boards with defense contractors, but because war brings eyeballs to TV sets. And you know, war is just incredibly profitable. It is, you know, the ginning up to the Iraq war, made media stars. I mean, you've got the first Iraq war, arguably, made several of the people who are media stars right now. They got their cred by being media stars, by being reporters on the ground, or being, you know, anchors during the first Iraq war. And then the second Iraq war created a whole new generation of media stars. And it's just incredibly profitable for the networks. And that's one of the problems, I think, frankly, with this enormous concentration of wealth and power in a very, very small number of hands who have all these interlocking relationships. Duane, I got to move along, but I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Robert in San Jose. Robert, a minute before the break here. What's up?
Well, basically, I'll get straight to the point. One of the things that everybody keeps asking is the president raises taxes. Well, I thought, I read the Constitution, that Congress is one that raises taxes. The president doesn't raise taxes. So that's a stupid question to ask the candidate, that if they're, because the answer should be no. They won't raise taxes, but they will support those people and will sign into law maybe that those tax raises. But the Congress is one that raises taxes.
Yeah, representatives and direct taxes should be apportioned among the state, you know, et cetera. Yes, Congress. Yeah. Congress is all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. Section 7, Article 1 of the Constitution.
You're absolutely right. Whenever anybody sit back and they say, well, Reagan raised taxes or Reagan lowered taxes or this, that, and the other, they didn't do that.
No, although we do have a tradition now that goes back, I don't know how far, of the president proposing budgets, but you're absolutely right. It's up to Congress to decide whether or not to raise or lower taxes, period. I mean, they have final say, absolute final say in it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
I believe someday you're gonna do me proud. It's written on your soul to rise above the crowd. Hear the angels sing your praises right out loud. Yeah, I believe someday you're gonna do me proud.
It's simply yes or no question. Do you think Senator Obama can beat John McCain or not?
Well, I think we have to beat John McCain, and I have every reason to believe we're going to have a Democratic president, and it's going to be either Barack or me, and we're going to make that happen. And what is important is that we understand exactly the challenges facing us in order to defeat Senator McCain. He will be a formidable candidate. There isn't any doubt about that.
The question is, do you think Senator Obama can do that? Can he win?
Yes, yes, yes. Now, I think that I can do a better job. I mean, obviously, that's why I'm here.
Senator Obama, do you think Senator Clinton can win?
Absolutely, and I've said so before. But I, too, think that I'm the better candidate. And I don't think that surprises anybody.
There you go. 866-303-2270, our number. Ben in Hudson Valley, New York. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Tom. You know, you've said something today that I've heard repeated many times by yourself and others, that it's better if this salacious type of stuff, you know, this Bittergate stuff, this Reverend Wright stuff, that if this comes out now rather than later, it's somehow you think that's a positive. And I couldn't disagree more. There's a huge difference between having your entire party behind you and defending you against the other party than it is when you have to defend yourself against half of your own party and the other party.
I agree with you on that point. I absolutely agree with you, Ben. Okay. And that's, and I would love for there only to be one candidate right now and for us to be united and right. Be having these debates with the McCain camp about, you know, whether somebody's wearing a flag pin or whatever, rather than with among two Democrats. I agree. But that's right. Not what we have. That's not the reality we have.
No, it's not. It's not the reality we have, but it's a reality that some people seem to applaud. Like, I'll give a quick example. I could use either one, but I used the Bittergate thing. Rendell is going around to Pennsylvania, and I campaigned quite a bit in Pennsylvania, and I've actually seen town meetings in Pennsylvania to bash Barack for, you know, misconstruing what Pennsylvanians are all about, how he's not in touch with our religion and all this nonsense. Now, if this had happened, if he had made this exact same statement after being the Democratic nominee, the exact opposite would have happened. Rendell and all these mayors would have said, oh, of course Barack is right. We do have a lot of angry, bitter people, and our goal is to make them better, not to drown out.
I absolutely agree with you, Ben, and that's why throughout this I have been on this program and in my writings I have been saying to directly and indirectly to the Clinton campaign, to the extent that I can, you know, I don't know if anybody's listening, please tell us why to vote for you rather than why not to vote for him.
Well, exactly. I think what she's doing is she's appealing not to Reagan Democrats. I think she's appealing to Lieberman Democrats. And I think what she's doing is she's validating...
Well, Lieberman got kicked out of the Democratic Party, so there's not many Lieberman Democrats left. Yeah. I mean, Ned Lamont cleaned his clock.
Yeah, no, I understand. But you see, here's the thing. When she says these things over and over again, it's quite different from McCain saying them, because what she's doing is she's validating that tactic. She's sort of giving a stamp of approval from the official Democratic Party.
I absolutely agree with you, I think it's a shame. And that said, you know, we have to figure out some way to make some lemonade out of these lemons. And, you know, so let's get this stuff out and let's get it behind us. Matthew in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Matthew.
Hello.
What's up?
Hi. I'd like to talk about Reverend Wright and another thing also. But Reverend Wright, this has not been really brought up quite a bit. He was a former United States Marine.
Right, and he was a medic who actually served at the bedside of, as I recall, Lyndon Johnson, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, he was honorably discharged, Marine. You know, he could say what he wants. It's a free country.
Yeah.
A lot of people are angry with the United States, you know, Americans, the way things are being run right now. Another thing, these lapel pins, they're made in China.
Yeah, that's the ultimate irony, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. Matthew, thank you. Well, point well made. Fred in Orange County, California. Hey, Fred.
Hello. Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, I didn't get mad at ABC. I just simply called them and left them a nice little comment on their comment line and tell them how I felt like they were performing like Fox last night, and they were unfair to Obama, and they didn't stick to the issues, and they were just mudslinging, and how I can never ever tune them on and or watch them anymore.
So I think
very easy. Anybody can call that.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, with the media right across the board, radio, television, newspapers, whatever it may be, letting them know what you're thinking and letting them know that you're actually consuming or not consuming their product is something that is probably a fairly useful thing to do. Elle in Portland, Oregon. Elle?
Yes, hi. I watched the debate last night, and I have to tell you, I kind of have a lot of empathy for Chicago Cub fans. I figure this must be how they feel. Just shaking my head and thinking to myself, my poor Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, they just don't seem to be able to get it together. They are able to always seem to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. And I saw three things in that debate where they could have turned it around. And one is they keep on talking about Bush and his tax cuts. Well, it should be reframed as Bush and the Republican tax cuts.
Right, and it shouldn't even be called tax cuts. It should be Bush and his deficit spending borrowing from our children to give money to billionaires and millionaires.
But it shouldn't just be Bush. Bush, it took a Republican Congress to pass those tax cuts.
You're right, you're right. And
so,
but see, the fact of the matter is they were not tax cuts. No taxes were... Taxes
right.
Ultimately have to be paid. It was a tax deferral. Those taxes are going to have to be paid by the next generation.
However they want to frame it, Tom, as long as someone gets to our Democrats and tell them to start making sure they're not running against Bush in November. They're running against the Republicans, and they couldn't have gotten all of this through Bush unless the Republicans went with it. Then the second thing, I mean, I understand the importance of symbols. I'm a faculty, and I have to tell you, even I get that, you know? And it would be so silly for Obama to lose on such a small thing. I mean, I applaud his fact that he says, you know, we're going to look on the larger issues. But what about a constitutional pin made in America?
There you go.
And his straw could be save the Constitution.
That's a great idea. That's a great symbol. Elle, thank you very much for the call. Barack Obama wearing a Constitution pin. Yeah, I would endorse that. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And David Korn on the line with us. He's a journalist, author, and the D.C. Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine, the website motherjones.com. David, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. You have written an absolutely brilliant article here. Cops and former Secret Service agents ran black ops on green groups. And no, it's not about puns and color. This is truly bizarre stuff.
Well, I have to correct you a slight bit. The piece was written by James Ridgway, but I did a lot of reporting on it.
Excuse me.
And I was the editor on the piece, so I have sort of I share credit. But Jim's is the name on the byline.
Okay. Okay. So let's talk about this. This private security organization, Becca Brown International, later called S2I. Now, you know, I have no problem with a private corporation saying, hey, we'll provide security, actually, this company has provided security for, you know, a bunch of groups, for Bill Clinton's second inauguration, which actually you would think should not be privatized. But,
yeah.
But you know, saying that they'll look into what's, you know, advertising practices, trade practices, things like that, but dumpster diving?
Well, yeah. I mean, this firm is like many others, unfortunately. There's a whole, you know, industry of private security firms, and it was set up and run by former members of the Secret Service. And, you know, they did a lot of work. They targeted the Mars Candy Company on the behalf of Nestle's. They looked at waste management, a trash firm on behalf of Browning Ferris, another competitor. And they did surveillance for Mary Kay Cosmetics. They did, you know, work for Walmart. They did all these things. But what we focused on in our piece was that they penetrated Greenpeace and other operations. And in one instance, they put an operative on the board of a community environmental group in Louisiana that was working with Greenpeace and others and to get information on what they were all up to. But what one tactic that they used both in their corporate cases and in going against their green targets was dumpster diving, as they called it. One sort of code term they used for it within their company records was D-line, as in the letter D. And what they would do is they'd go and they'd find trash and go through it and look for, you know, intelligence on what these targets were doing. People ask, is this illegal? And it depends on the state, but the general principle is if you put your trash out by the curb and someone picks it up, that's, you know, that's fine. People can do that. But if someone has to sort of go onto your private property, let alone climb a fence or get behind a gate, which is what they had to do in a lot of these circumstances, well, they have at least trespassing, and then, you know, it might actually be considered more theft than just picking up what someone's throwing out. And so they had operatives. They had people who were, at least one instance, a D.C. cop. They had former cops who would case office buildings and offices to find the best way to get the garbage, and they would try in certain circumstances to bribe the garbage delivery guys, the pickup guys, to get them to hand over the trash. And they would go, we have a tale of a midnight raid where they dressed all in black, like out of Mission Impossible, to get trash from Greenpeace. And in doing so, they found, you know, financial records, client lists in some cases, social security numbers of staff people, and strategy memos, all these things that, you know, that they probably should have been shredding but weren't, and put them into intelligence that they produced for their corporate clients who wanted to spy on these environmental groups and on corporate competitors.
So here's the question, David. We're talking with David Korn, who is the D.C. Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine, which is running this new exclusive cops and former Secret Service agents running black ops on green groups. What's wrong with this?
Well, what's wrong with it is that if you're breaking the law to begin with, I mean, there's an ethical issue.
So you're suggesting that they're doing something that would require, if it was done by a police agency, would require a warrant they'd have to go before a judge and get a warrant.
Well, sure, but I mean, if you're trespassing on someone's property to get access to their garbage, that's breaking law. In one instance, we have an email in which they talk about using a badge, meaning the police badge of an officer who's freelancing for them to get access to buildings. And you know, someone shows the police badge and says, "I'm here. I want to look in your basement." Most office buildings are going to say, "Sure, come right on in."
Right.
There's a violation of privacy, which is an ethical level too, which may be not an illegal issue, but that's at stake here.
So
you have corporations that have that have engaged in tremendous acts of pollution and violating the bespoiling the environment and such. And if instead of cleaning up their act, they're spying on Greenpeace, I'd argue that's pretty wrong too.
That's wrong in a moral sense. I mean, in the legal sense, it seems that if they are breaking the law, I mean, if you can document that these guys have actually broken the law, that they've broken and entered, that they've trespassed, that they've engaged in theft, why not bring a complaint against them and charge them with a crime?
Well, we have some of the people who are targets who are going through these records now and considering just that. You can also, I'm not a lawyer, but some instances you can sue people for a violation of privacy. So there are lawyers for targets, not just the environmental groups, like some of the corporations that have been.
Because I mean, this could turn around, David. I mean, at a certain level, you see Greenpeace out there. I don't know if you saw the clip. I think it was yesterday or the day before, the video clip of them, trying to keep the Japanese from doing their whaling.
Right.
And the Japanese are calling them terrorists. I mean,
sure.
if Greenpeace was to decide that, pick a corporation, here in the case in your article, you had Taco Bell, getting genetically modified corn by accident into their tacos or whatever.
Yes.
If Greenpeace decided to do some espionage on Taco Bell and started dumpster diving, I don't think that, we would be quite as concerned. I mean, we would like to know if a corporation is engaging in malfeasance. So, we need to, as a practical thing, don't we need to kind of set aside our agendas and just say, where are the legal guidelines here? Where does this stop and begin? What is appropriate in our society and what's legal in our society?
Well, there are state laws that govern, these sort of matters. Obviously, some difference from state to state. And, anytime Greenpeace goes out there and scales a building and puts up a banner, they're breaking the law. But when they do it, they're willing to go to jail. It's
right.
called civil disobedience,
right.
And they're doing it out front.
Well, I wasn't even talking about that. I was talking about Ralph Nader's groups. I mean, Public Citizen has done some great research, and I'm sure it wasn't all done with a clipboard knocking on doors.
No, but there are groups that have engaged in dumpster diving. There are journalists who have done so, and the question I would put to in terms of evaluating this is whether they've followed the law. And also, there is an issue here of, people say that this is sort of being, relativistic, but of why you're doing it.
Right.
If you're doing it to discredit a group that's trying to protect the environment, as opposed to doing it to, find out about a group that might be poisoning the environment, you might have a different set of standards. At least, you might say that the law should treat them the same, but I'm going to regard it personally, in a different manner.
Yeah, and this really brings up the second issue, which, beyond the legality, which is, 1984 is here. And we have met Big Brother, and it's not what we thought. It's not the government. Actually, in the case of the Bush administration, I suppose it is, arguably, at some levels. But
no,
Big Brother
right.
has a corporate logo attached to it.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I don't worry, but if I were to worry, I'd be much more concerned about private spying and the misuse of my private information by corporations, whether they be credit companies or groups that are trying to sell me things, or groups that are using private security firms to find out information on me. I'd be much more worried about that than the government. I've written books on the CIA. I've been very critical of various administrations, and people have always said, you think they're watching you, spying on you? I tend not. I hope to think they have better things to do with their time.
Well, and ultimately, they're accountable to us.
Yeah,
under the Constitution.
What happened here was you had high-powered corporations hiring high-powered public relations firms who then contract out to this particular private security firm. I mean, there are many others who do the same sort of work, and you know they create this this chain of plausible deniability. You know they create different veils that are hard to break through. They all do this all privately. You know, I mean, Congress couldn't even come knocking and would have a hard time investigating this stuff. And I do think that the private accumulation of intelligence and information on us American citizens is more worrisome. And you know, but I hear the music, so let me just remind people they can read the actual piece at motherjones.com.
Yeah, I would have done that for you, but got it. And this is about cops and former Secret Service agents running black ops on green groups. The author, James Ridgway, David Korn, the D.C. Bureau Chief and Editor over at Mother Jones Magazine. David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome. We're all Americans here, right? 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, our website, AirAmerica.com for those blogs and information about the network. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our blogs there. Peter in Portland, Oregon, you're an attorney. You have some thoughts on dumpster diving?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of misunderstanding out there about the legality of going through people's garbage, and police often misunderstand this as much as anybody. There's two things that bear on this. One is that there was a Supreme Court case that held that the police had the right to go through people's garbage without a warrant. And this holding was mainly because the garbage was placed outside what's called the curtilage of the person's home. In other words, outside the general area of their home and the immediate surroundings of their home.
Right. So when the Fourth Amendment says that we have the reasonable assumption of privacy in our papers, our possessions, and our residence, I'm paraphrasing, that means not at our property boundary, but rather the walls of our house.
More or less, in an area close to the house, and that's an area that's litigated. But the other thing that's confusing to people is the law of abandonment. And police will often tell you when you place your garbage at the curb, you're giving everybody permission to go through it. That's not the case. You're specifically placing the garbage, usually in a can marked for pickup by your sanitation carrier. That is not abandoned property. You are actually following regulations that generally the city will place on you as to where you have to place your garbage. Hmm. It's not abandoned property.
So it's a transfer of ownership of property from one party to another party.
Correct.
And if a third party interferes with that, is that a torturous interference?
That's conversion. That's conversion.
Yeah.
Which is theft.
Larceny by conversion. Right.
Right. And so a lot of people misunderstand this, and we have a similar problem here in Portland with recycling, where people are going around taking bottles and cans out of the yellow recycling bins, thinking that they have every right to do so, when in fact they don't by common law. And, in fact, there's a city ordinance that forbids it. And some cities, some jurisdictions, have equivalent ordinances covering garbage.
Yeah, very interesting. Peter, thank you very much for the for the law lesson. It's much appreciated. I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners on earth on this program. Amy in Maryland. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Yeah, hi. Couple things. One, I saw that the debate really highlighted Hillary's entire argument for her candidacy, which is really you have to not only accept but embrace the Republican frame in order to fight with them. And, you know, she says,
do you think that that's the rationale for her candidacy for president, or do you think that to the extent that that's true, and I think to some extent it is, that's simply her, what she's trying to say to the superdelegates and the voters is, these are the tools that will be used to defeat the Democrat in the fall. I'm going to throw these tools at Barack Obama. If he can withstand them, he can legitimately be our candidate. If he withers in front of them, he shouldn't have been our candidate in the first place. I will not wither in front of them because I've stood up to them as both the United States Senator and a First Lady. Isn't that really her message?
Well, maybe that's part of it, but what I'm saying is that she's saying the only way to fight them is on their terms, and I can do that. And he refuses to do that. He tries to transcend their terms.
Right.
And I think what's interesting is that the only time the Democrats succeeded in you know, sort of trying to do that, you know, being DLC Democrats was with her husband, who didn't get 50% of the vote.
Right. Although he, you know, you could argue that he didn't succumb to the Republican frames either, at least in the 92 election. Bill Clinton ran as a progressive, even though he ultimately governed as a moderate or even as a conservative. He ran as a progressive, and, you know, they had that it's the economy stupid thing, and they kept bringing it back to pocketbook issues. No matter what the Republicans threw at them, they, you know, Bill Clinton would answer, yeah, and what does that have to do with, you know, is your life any better now than it was?
Well,
you know, for that matter, Ronald Reagan used the same thing against Jimmy Carter. He said, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Actually, Americans were better off at the end of the Carter administration than they were 4 years earlier,
but
Carter didn't have the answer. You know,
that is a good point. But I also felt that well, it really bugged me when she laughed at the McCain joke about audacity of hope. I mean, she really enjoyed it, you know. And I thought, and I was also disappointed that Obama didn't say the real way to fight the Republicans is to not have voted for the Iraq War.
Yeah, there. Well, see, again, he has been very careful not to draw blood, and I think he's trying very hard not to draw blood. In part because, you know, the Reagan's 11th commandment, and which, you know, is a long time thing. I mean, it long predates Reagan, and in part because there's some small chance that she may be the party's nominee, and he doesn't want to harm the party's nominee.
Yeah.
You know, I salute him for that. I think that's a marvelous thing. He is not using that same frame that she is of, okay, this is how the Republicans are going to get him, so we've got to get him first, and we'll see. But actually, what I would suggest to you is because she has been throwing Republican talking points at Barack Obama, and he has stood up to them, and he has, you know, gone through the right controversy, whatnot, that demonstrates that he actually can defeat the Republicans on those terms. So now they've got to come up with another set of terms. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. 5-1, baby. 1-5. No one here gets out alive now.
Yeah, they've got the guns, but we've got the numbers. We're taking over, right? Remember that? Yes, indeed. Nothing like the Doors to get us going. 34 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, the Director of Strategic Communications, on the line with us. Hey, Christy.
I love the Doors. That just made me so happy.
That's our activism alert. You know that. Actually, I typically play the part where he yells, you know, they've got the guns and we've got the numbers. We're taking over.
I guess that means that's a little better than playing the part where he just starts yelling, "I'm the Lizard King."
Yeah. Although I'll go for that too.
It doesn't make as much sense, but it's still pretty good. How are you?
I am great. And you?
I'm fine, thank
good,
you.
Good. The Liberty City 7 are a little better today too.
I am so fired up about this story because, once again, Tom, the mainstream media, I don't know if they're lazy or if they got a lobotomy or they just are forgetful, but they...
Or it's a story that doesn't go with the Bush narrative and they're afraid of drawing the ire and the fire of the Bush administration.
Something like that, but the story was reported yesterday and they left out half. The story that came out yesterday was, Liberty City 7. These are these seven guys who were arrested because they supposedly were with Al-Qaeda and they were planning to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago. And they were down in Miami and it was this big deal when it happened. And when they were arrested back in 06, for example, Alberto Gonzalez came out and, you know, this is the greatest breakthrough ever, and this shows how, you know, tough we are on terrorism, and this is why we need to, you know, keep wiretapping you. And they really used the arrest of these seven guys to...
We have terrorists in America!
Exactly. Be scared, be scared, be scared. Right. Vote for us, give us money, yeah. Give away your privacy, look what happens, we'll get these guys down in Miami.
And it seemed to help.
And it did. People.
I mean, this was the summer of 2006. This was right before the 2006 elections.
Exactly. And I remember I bought it. One of these days I'll stop buying, you know, what they try and sell. But at the time I was like, oh my goodness, they got these terrorists down in Miami. Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so yesterday, the U.S. District Judge who's hearing the case had to dismiss the case for the second time because it was a mistrial. Deadlocked jury was not going to undeadlock. And so the first mistrial was back in December. This was the second mistrial.
And this jury was out for 13 days?
13 days.
13 business days, working days, or 13? Well, I guess it doesn't matter. It's 13 days is a long time.
I don't think they count the weekends because they're not deliberating, but I am not positive about that.
So more or less 2 weeks.
So, and so the government wants to try these guys again. And they're going to have a hearing on the 23rd to see if there can be a third trial against these guys. But here's where it gets interesting, and here's what everybody is skipping, okay? The reason that there was a mistrial wasn't because the jurors were stupid or the jurors didn't care about terrorism. The reason there was a mistrial was this was this weird, weird setup where basically these seven guys were these just random guys who met in somebody's basement, and they decided they were going to become this gang. And there was this huge story last summer, it all broke, in the Washington Post. And basically all these guys did was smoke pot, practice fake karate, and come up with these plans about how they were going to recruit people to carry out their missions with bows and arrows.
This is like a bad version of Spanky and Our Gang. You know?
It's kind of like when they got tired of Dungeons and Dragons, so they decided it was just these dorks in some basement who were coming up with this, oh, what if we were this, you know, this bad gang?
Yeah.
And so they had no money. They had no training. They had no weaponry expertise. They had nothing. So along come two FBI guys. And the FBI guys saw this gang. And this is what the FBI guys gave them, money, a way to join Al-Qaeda, an official Al-Qaeda swearing-in ceremony that they filmed.
Wait a minute, there is such a thing?
I guess there is.
So they made it up.
Video cameras for surveillance, cell phones, suggestions for a first target, an official headquarters. So basically the FBI came and said, here's everything you could actually need to be a terrorist cell.
Right, and then they went in the news and they said, holy cow, look at these guys. They've got cell phones, they've got a headquarters, they've got money, look at that.
And we've got videotape of their swearing-in ceremony for Al-Qaeda.
Right.
And then these guys were arrested. And there was no plot there without the FBI's help. And even when they got arrested last year, when Alberto Gonzalez was out cheerleading it, the FBI agents who, different FBI agents who arrested them said, well, this terrorist plan is, quote, aspirational rather than operational. AKA, they've got some weird, wacky ideas, but there's absolutely no way they could carry them out without the help of the FBI.
Right. And to the extent that ideas aren't illegal in the United States, well, actually, I guess at a certain level they are. We have conspiracy laws, but that's about as far as it goes.
Well, right, but they're not usually aimed at guys smoking pot practicing fake karate chops in a basement somewhere.
Right, and typically the conspiracy laws are directed against people who are actually capable of executing the conspiracy.
Right. So just the fact that, A, the government made such a big deal over something that was not actually a plot. You know, if it were, if they actually did uncover a terrorist plot, more power to them. I'm very excited about it. But to make up a fake plot to then disrupt just seems really like a waste of time to me. And, B, the fact that they're not giving this up. They have decided to keep going, and they're going to try for a third trial.
Could that be because if they walk away from it now, they could be facing a substantial lawsuit for false arrest, false imprisonment, you know, whatever, that kind of thing?
Well, probably not. I mean, these guys I don't think would have much of a leg to stand on because they did, once they were offered things like a terrorist attack target, cell phones and an Al-Qaeda swearing-in official ceremony, I don't know, with punch and cookies at the end, they accepted it. So they're not actually, you know, they're not great guys.
Well, to that extent, then it's legal entrapment. It's sort of like the guys who say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't realize that lady was a cop when I offered her $100. You know, it's still, so you were entrapped. So what? You still committed the crime.
Right, right. So, you know, it does get a little legally sticky there, but one of the seven has already been acquitted. And so the Liberty City 7 is actually the Liberty City 6. And so we'll see what happens on the 23rd. But it really just gets me because it's so indicative of what the government tried to do to freak us all out.
Right. I guess the carry home message for everybody is, you know, if you're sitting around in your basement smoking pot with your buddies and you come up with a gee whiz idea and some guy with a crew cut and shiny black shoes knocks on your door and says, you want some money? Tell him no.
Right.
No thanks.
Say no. and the little fake Al Qaeda swearing in ceremony when they videotape that. Yeah, you might not want to do that one.
Yeah, right. Not a good idea. Okay. Speaking of you know, fake ceremonies or fake whatever. Here, John McCain has his economic plan, and it's going to be a $1.7 trillion tax cut for corporations. Corporations right now. This is from the annual report of Berkshire Hathaway last year, right?
Right.
Warren Buffett's company. No shirk, no slouches. I mean, you know, they do their math. It's right. This is literally from their annual report. Corporate taxes are at the lowest level since 1934. They constitute 7.4% of all federal tax receipts, down from 32% in 1952.
Wow.
And so, yeah, right. So the corporations right now are paying about one-fourth of the cost of the commons compared to what they were paying in 52, and during a time when corporations were doing very well, thank you very much.
Right.
And McCain wants to give them an even bigger tax break, and when Andrea Mitchell calls him on it, and a few other folks, he says what?
Well, that's the thing. He came out with this economic plan, and what he said was, oh, this is for the middle class, this is for you. Then when you look at the details, you know, there's twice as much of a tax cut for big corporations than there are for families, and you can't pay for it. It would cost at least $100 billion more than he said it would. So, yeah, Andrea Mitchell called him on it and said, look, your tax plan doesn't make any sense. And
her husband, by the way, is Alan Greenspan, who knows how to do math.
Right. And so Andrea Mitchell says, you know, there's these experts who say that your plan doesn't make any sense. And McCain came out and said, and this is a direct quote, I disagree. I disagree with the experts. I disagree. I disagree. I disagree with the experts. I have experts of my own. So he's basically saying that, yeah, maybe all of the economists and math geniuses and everybody, they may disagree with his economic plan, but he's going to stick to it.
Hey, it worked for Reagan.
It did.
You know, it's voodoo economics, but, you know, nobody will notice for another generation. And that's what happened. I mean, you know, Reagan ran us into debt, and this year you and I will spend, you know, the average American will pay about $1,000 in taxes on the interest on the debt that was run up by Reagan, Bush, and Bush.
Right, right. So this is basically the McCain equivalent of sticking his fingers in his ears and yelling, Mary had a little lamb, I'm sticking to this tax plan that makes no sense.
Right. We just have a minute left here, Christy. 1 in 5 Iraq and Afghanistan vets have PTSD. This is a more serious
Very sad, yes. Issue. 1 out of every 5 returning vets has post-traumatic stress disorder, and that adds up to about 300,000 U.S. troops who are coming home suffering from this.
And yet John McCain still has not signed on to the new GI Bill of Rights.
Still hasn't signed on, and there's still not enough money for veterans to get both the treatment they need and to get the health benefits that they need.
Yeah.
Very sad.
Yeah, it is. And finally, Joe Manchin.
Joe, the former vice presidential candidate, he wants to be the keynote speaker at the Republican convention in September.
Joe Lieberman is having his Zell Miller moment, I think.
He definitely is. Joe Lieberzell.
Right. I'm waiting for him to challenge Chris Matthews to a duel.
Oh, I would love
it's
that.
It's coming. I'm telling you. It's coming.
I'm watching for it.
Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website, MikeCheckRadio.org as well. Christy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Always great talking.
Bye-bye.
45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
as I walked out tonight in the mystic garden. The wounded flowers were dangling from the vine. I was passing by a young cool crystal fountain. Someone hit me from behind. Ain't talking, just walking through this weary world of the world.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, you went to the correspondence dinner last night. You got to hear,
Mr.
Cheney.
And I've got to tell you, the funniest person was Mitt Romney, followed by the vice president, and the third and least funny person was the comedian.
Really? That's
yeah.
Interesting. Just for our listeners, we've got a little bit of Cheney audio here. Here he is.
You and the press need to go easy on Senator Clinton on the whole business about running and ducking from gunfire in Bosnia. She made an honest mistake. She confused the Bosnia trip with the time I took her hunting.
And then there's there's another.
Barack Obama and I have had our disagreements, and frankly, I do wish he'd keep these things in the family.
Yeah. He's got a good writer.
He's got an excellent writer, and the comedian, I just thought, was we were most of us at the table were sitting there and horrified. I just don't know why they don't stop using comedians and just use the politician.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if the politicians have good enough writers, I mean, to become a politician, you have to be pretty decent at delivery.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so what's going on in the world?
And they also know the audience, and the audience is a bunch of press people.
Right.
Well, I think the biggest news today, I mean, there's a lot of news, but the biggest news today is this GAO report that came out. And Senator Reid immediately commented on it and basically said that the Bush administration, and I'll go into the report in a second, but the Bush administration, commitment of our limited resources to the war has compromised our focus in the region that is home to Al-Qaeda. And then,
wait a minute,
some
is the GAO that said this?
What?
This
the
is
GAO.
The...
Let me tell you what the GAO. I got to read you the full quote. I hate to read on the radio, but there's only one way to do it.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda is now using the Pakistani safe haven to put the last element necessary to launch another attack against America into place, including the identification, training, and positioning of Western operatives for an attack. It's stated that Al-Qaeda is most likely to use these groups to plot terrorist attacks and infrastructure targets in America designed to produce mass casualties, visually dramatic destruction, significant economic aftershocks, and or fear among the population. That's from the GAO report.
Wow. That's astounding.
It is totally astounding.
And is it getting any coverage in the corporate media?
Well, it's hard to know because it literally just came out, you know, it's just been sort of on the racks 2 or 3 hours.
Right.
So it's really hard to know. I think that Pelosi will probably come out with a statement just a little bit later. I believe she's having a presser either later this afternoon or tomorrow morning. And so she'll clearly come out with a statement. It'll be interesting to see what she says.
Yeah.
And as you know, there has been about $10.5 billion in U.S. military and economic aid to the Pakistani government in the last year. Now, that's, of course, nothing compared to what we're spending in Iraq. But to know that this is going on is just unbelievable. And Robert Menendez of New Jersey said, for anyone wondering how we're doing in the fight to get terrorists who killed 3,000 Americans on 9/11, this report pretty much says it all.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. So what else? What else is up?
Another report. Today's the day of reports.
Yeah.
The RAND Corporation, not exactly a liberal think tank or a liberal business, said that they released a study that said 300,000 U.S. service personnel are suffering from major depression or post-traumatic stress disorder from their service in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that there is a good portion of these people, perhaps as much as 19%, had experienced a possible traumatic brain injury at some point during their deployment,
right.
And that only less than half, 43%, were being evaluated by a doctor for their head injuries.
Yeah, this is so. This, we were just talking
about 500-page study.
Yeah, we were just talking with Christy Harvey about this, and yesterday we were talking with Larry Scott about it, and in fact, I mean, this has led to things like down in Dallas, they had to shut down, you know, one of the psychiatric hospitals after, I believe it was four guys committed suicide. I mean, they're just, the Veterans Administration is overwhelmed, and the guy who is the political appointee, Bush's political appointee, and you can read all about this over at VAWatchdog.org, is one of these small government, you know, hyper-conservatives who's all about, you know, cutting costs and the VA is socialized medicine kind of stuff, you know.
Well, there's another very high-stress job, somewhat related to 9/11, although not exactly, where there have actually, and this has been totally unreported, but there have been many pilots who have been killing themselves. High-stress, many of them are vets. Some may not be Iraq vets, but again, you know, we know we're stressing our pilot system.
Wow.
So a lot of that's not being reported. There's just a lot of things that, you know, are still under the radar screen at large. And then, you know, there's Condoleezza Rice heading over to, I believe she's going up to Kuwait, and she's talking about, well, now it's really time for these other countries surrounding Iraq to contribute and help stabilize the area.
Gee, like about 5 years late, isn't she?
My vision is of the people on two separate planes, and they just don't meet.
Yeah, yeah, it's absolutely bizarre. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you today. The Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. You can find out more at teamster.org. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Your chance to ask a U.S. senator your questions and get them answered. Plus, Anything Goes Friday. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.